Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Frank Viscuso, 27 years of career experience, second-generation firefighter who rose through the ranks of his department with the town of Kearny, New Jersey, and retired as deputy fire chief, author of 10, yes, 10 books, including the bestsellers Step Up and Lead and Step Up Your Teamwork. Since retiring, Frank has traveled all across the world, offering many seminars, workshops, and keynotes on the topics of leadership and team development. One of the quotes that stuck out to me in our conversation was this: "Conceive it before you achieve it." I truly hope the listeners can gain a little bit of value from what Frank spoke on. With that, I present Mr. Frank Viscuso.
My name is Frank Viscuso, and how I got into the fire service is a pretty interesting question. My brother and my father are firefighters. I should actually start by saying before my brother became a firefighter, it was his lifelong dream. And I don't really know what my lifelong dream was back then. I was still trying to figure it out. Matter of fact, I'm still trying to figure it out to this day. But I was a college athlete out in University of Charleston out in West Virginia. And I was on a rowing team. And when I came back for a break, my brother was out in the backyard training for the fire exam, the physical portion of the fire exam. And in a conversation with him, my father and my brother, we talked about whether or not I should take the test as well. And I remember my father saying, "Hey, take it. You never know." And I thought, "Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I really want to be a firefighter." But my brother made the mistake of challenging me, saying, "You couldn't beat me on a test anyway," because he was specifically training for it. And I'm thinking, I'm a college athlete. What makes you think I couldn't beat you, you know, on a physical fitness exam? So I signed up to take the test. And here's the best part of it. He beat me, but we both got offered the job. And here's why I say this is the best part of it, because I learned a valuable lesson that day. It doesn't matter if you're an athlete. It doesn't matter if you're talented, because I find that grit and determination are the great equalizer. My brother wanted the job. He wanted a job enough to train for it, to give everything he had to get it. And at that time, I didn't have that passion or drive for that particular goal. I'm very grateful for him because it's the best thing that happened to me. But I learned a valuable lesson, and it was, you know, if you want something bad enough, it's hard to be denied. So that's a little bit about my story, how I became a firefighter, and I'm grateful for the journey I've been on.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So needless to say, is your brother older or younger than you?
He's older. He's 3 years older.
Okay.
3 years wiser and about 3 inches shorter.
So it's safe to say, like, you're third generation, right?
Well, second generation, being my brother. Yeah, my grandfather wasn't in the service, and who knows if any of our children are going to end up in the service to make it a third generation. But, you know, back then, it was pretty cool because, you know, growing up in Kearny, New Jersey, everybody knew everybody. And it was a large Scottish population, a large Irish population, and a decent-sized Italian population, but everybody knew everybody. And so when we went to take the test, it was like hundreds of people from my high school and all around town. It's like everybody, it's like a night out. You know, it's like you're looking around the room going, "Hey, this is everybody I know in this room right now," which was a really interesting thing looking back on it. And it's not like that now. Now it's more, I don't want to say segregated, just not as intimate as it was back then. But it was a good time, you know. But when I got on the job, I got on the job with guys I wrestled with, guys I rode with, kids that I grew up with, would go camping with when I was younger because our parents would take us there and our parents were firefighters. So, you know, we had that kind of connection, which was very cool.
Okay. So I'm going to fast forward just a little bit. Both of you get hired. Were both of you in the same recruit class? Did they do a recruit class back then?
They did do recruit classes. We did not get in the same recruit class. He was, I don't remember where he was on the list. Back at this point, I don't remember where either one of us were.
Mm-hmm.
I could tell you we were both top 20, and I can tell you he was significantly higher than me. He, I think, was on the first class to come out of there. Was probably on the job for about a year and a half, actually 2 years longer than I've been on a job. And but that list was good for 3 years. So a couple of years later, and it was interesting because he was at the time he was in the police academy. He left the police academy to pursue firefighting. And this is what he wanted. And I often joke saying I know a lot of people that became firefighters that were police officers. I don't know that many that went in the opposite direction, but I do meet quite a few of them along my journey the last few years of going around and speaking all throughout the country. But I mean, my family's been very, very blessed and grateful to be on this journey, that's for sure.
With that being said, with you having really no aspirations to be a firefighter, once you got into recruit class, how was your experience seeing what it truly is to become a firefighter?
Well, I mean, my first thought was, okay, so this is the real shit. All right, I can't mess around here. So I had to really think long and hard. All right, is this what I want to do? And it's funny because people say firefighting is the greatest job on earth. I'm not going to say it's not. I believe it is. However, prior to me becoming a firefighter, I was a lifeguard on the Jersey Shore. And I could tell you at that age in a person's life, lifeguarding is definitely the greatest job on earth. Okay. So, I'm going from sitting on a beach, not that, I mean, it was just a summer gig, obviously, but I'm going from sitting on a beach and we made rescues and everything. It's not like we weren't active and we trained a lot. It's the real deal. But I go from that to all of a sudden crawling around in buildings. And I'm like, okay, I kind of prefer the ocean to the basement fire. But there's a couple things associated with it. Of course, there is the adrenaline aspect of it, which is something that goes without denying that that's a very real thing. There's the aspect of being part of a team. I always love being part of a team. So here's another team to be a part of, and that was drawing. And then there was the greatest part of it all, which is you get to help people. And I'm not one that grew up saying, if you were to say, what do you want to do with your life? Hey, I really want to help people. I really like people. It's not the type of personality I was, and I don't mean that in a negative way. I'm being real and saying that I was very reclusive type of person. I was an introvert. I still am, believe it or not. I'm an introvert. I'm a person that if I could be in a room of 60 people, and I'll be the one sitting in a corner just watching, and I could be having as good a time as anybody else. But see, I'll tell you something, Danny, and I speak about this a lot. When I'm doing seminars, I grew up as an overthinker, a guy that had a bit of an inferiority complex, a person that dealt with stress, anxiety, panic attacks. I didn't know how to process it when I was younger. Didn't know where it came from, didn't know what it stemmed from, didn't know how to deal with it. And back then, it wasn't like people were talking about, mental health and talking to people if you feel something's wrong. No, I just thought there's something wrong with me. I don't know what it is. But I was very good at hiding it. And I was very good at just being one of the guys. And so all of a sudden when you're crawling around in a building and you're a person that's an overthinker and you're saying, wait, should I be in this job? I mean, you lay awake at night thinking, is this the job I want? And it didn't take this was and I, listen, I'm saying this as if this was like a 6 month process. It wasn't a 6 month process. It was a very quick process of no, I definitely want to do this. Because as soon as you go through that whole deal of going through the academy and the camaraderie and the bonding that you make, I'm like, this is great. I mean, looking back, even before I got on this call with you, I'm working on a new book. Ironically enough, I'm telling a story about a crew team and it takes place at West Point Academy. And the colonel in charge of the rowing program is giving a lesson on something that I want to talk to you about called Will It Make the Boat Go Faster? And as I'm writing this, I'm thinking, looking back, I wish I could go back and had set my aspirations when I was a freshman in high school of doing something big like being accepted into West Point Academy. I didn't have the grades. I didn't have the drive. I didn't have the probably anything it took when I was a freshman. But had I, and this is easy for us to look back and say, if I looked at things differently, if I knew then what I know now, which we all say that, right? I look back and say that could have been a tremendous journey to been on, but I was just too immature and too unfocused at the time. So I'm giving you a lot of stuff early on now, right? Because you know the ending is good. I end up as a pretty successful guy in multiple different industries. But I want anybody that's going to listen to this to know that it doesn't always start, but how you start, does not really determine how you end. So for me, it was all about the discovery of how do I get from where I am to where I want to be? What is that journey? And it's been a great one.
With that being said, upon completion of recruit class, what was your first assignment? And with the way your mind works, was it a no-brainer for you to go, I want to find the individuals that can make me a better fireman?
Well, I was lucky in that aspect. See, understand, my dad was on the job, and now my brother was on the job. So I had built-in mentors my entire life that I'm stepping onto the job. I mean, a man that the chief of the department at the time, he wasn't my uncle, but he was a guy I called uncle, because he was a good friend with my father. And so I walk in my very first day. I walk in and I didn't have the proper shirt. I had the t-shirt, but I didn't have the button-up shirt that you're supposed to have. I don't remember why I didn't have it. I know I wasn't given it yet. But I walked in and I think I was supposed to get it that day. And he walked up to me and I said, hi, Uncle George. And he looked at me, he says, I'm not Uncle George, I'm Chief. I said, oh, sorry. He goes, and where's your shirt? And I said, I don't have it yet. He goes, all right, we'll get it. And I thought right there, oh shit, this is real. This is real. Okay. And it was good. It was good. But you have to understand, like when you just step into this paramilitary type environment, when you didn't have that kind of background, you're stepping into it and you may not always be prepared. Matter of fact, one of the articles that I had written several years ago with co-authored with Chief Mike Turpak was 25 things every probationary firefighter should know and do. And ultimately, I wrote that because him and I were talking one day about the question you just asked. This is your new assignment, right? Like, what do you need to know going into it? What do you need to know? And, part of it is you need to know that the reputation that you're going to get in the first week could potentially last the next 25 years. And so my first assignment, was just on a particular group. I got assigned there with another firefighter who I went through the academy with, and that was great. I had some good mentors on the group. And it's great because I just went to a party just a couple weeks ago and ran into two of the guys that were on that group that I initially got assigned to, and we had the best time ever, man. I mean, we're talking, this is now 35 years later. Those guys have long retired. So, it's amazing though, the friendships, the bonds that you can build. But that was my assignment, man. My brother was on another group. Sometimes when I was off duty, I would go to his group and just kind of watch them train. Couldn't participate. It wasn't my duty day, but I knew where they were going to be and I would go down there. And if they were doing a pump operation drill, I'd stand by the driver and listen to him as he's telling me, so here's what this lever is and here's what you want to do here. Just help get me up to speed of where I needed to be, rather than just get it from my own group. I was trying to get as much information as I can, and a part of that was again just being that guy that was a bit of an overthinker. I'm like, I want to be ready for this. I want to be ready. Meanwhile, I'm still going to college. I'm not out at Charleston in West Virginia anymore. I'm at University of Well, now it's New Jersey State University, but it was Jersey City State College back then. I was still going to school part-time and working as firefighter.
All right. For those that don't know, including myself, granted, I'm from New York originally. I know about Jersey, but I don't know much about Kearney. So can you tell us the size, how many stations of that, things of that nature?
Yeah, Kearney's about 11 square miles. It's basically on a peninsula just sandwiched between Newark and Jersey City. We have 24 bridges coming in and out of Kearney. train bridges, but we also have two spans of the New Jersey Turnpike. It splits in Kearny, and we have the Pulaski Highway, which is the first elevated highway in America. You could essentially split Kearny up into three sections. You have your industrial section with millions of square feet of warehouse space. That's closest to Jersey City. You have your wetlands and landfill section, you know, where you have just a lot of marsh area. I thought mountains grew when I was younger. I didn't know it was garbage. But then you have your residential area, and maybe your residential area is maybe about 2, 2.5 square miles. But we have a, you know, last I know, about 42,000 people living there. So, you know, welcome to one of the most densely populated areas in the country when you're talking about Hudson County, New Jersey. And we have four stations, and three of them are uptown. One of them's considered downtown South Kearny, which is down in the industrial section we talked about earlier. And staffing level throughout my career has changed. When I first got on, there was four engines and two ladders. And by the time, you know, I had 25 years on, there was four engines and one ladder, but 16 members minimum. The ladder was fully staffed at four. Back then, when I was younger, it was just two on each ladder company. So I think a four-member ladder company worked better for us, made more sense. We have a rescue company also, but it's not staffed all full-time. If we have a, like a technical rescue or a confined space, high angle, something like that, well, then we'll bring the rescue out so we can get all that equipment there. And then we have a water rescue and water rescue team and water rescue training. And each station kind of operates a little differently. One will be in charge of decon, one will be in charge of water rescue, one will be in charge of confined space rescue. So we have decon chambers that are set up. And that, all the, a lot of this happened after 9/11 too, you know, because you know that the job description changes regularly in the fire service, probably every 10 years. You're adding something else. And so we've added a lot after that, like most teams have.
Okay. So of course, at most people should know, you know, you've rose through the ranks of with Kearny all the way up to deputy chief. I always like to ask the guests, at what point in your career did you decide to take a promotional test to move up and why?
That's a great question. The first one. Like I never passed up on one.
Okay.
Anytime I was eligible to take one, I would take it. I don't know how my brain works in a sense of if I ever were to go get tested for ADD, I might have it, you know?
Okay.
So, and I say that to start by telling you this. I was a guy who actually always studied, but I didn't always study because I was always seeking promotion. I always studied because I need massive repetitions to remember things. And so I would read books like Richmond's Engine Company Operations or Truck Company Operations or the one on your shelf, the Fire Officer Handbook of Tactics. I would read these books and I have would write notes and notes and notes. Like it's almost like I would transcribe the entire book. And not only that, when I started working on the computer, I would retype things that I wanted to remember. I remember when I read Responding to Routine Emergencies, I think I took about, if I don't remember the exact number, but it was something like 42 pages of notes that I typed. And when I looked back at that years later, I'm like, I pretty much retyped the entire book. And but that's how my brain was learning. So when it came time to take promotional exams, I had a lot of information in there. It wasn't like I was one of these people that said, okay, it's time. Okay, we have a test in 3 months. Let's start studying now. What I started studying 3 months before the exam was not the job. I was always studying the job. What I started studying was the test. What's the test going to be? And that was the difference, because it's like if they would say you're going to, as an example, when we study for deputy chief, you're given four scenarios: a fire, a non-fire, which could be a hazmat confined space collapse, something like that, a administrative scenario, and a supervision scenario. So once I understood the format and I learned the format every single day for over a month, I gave myself the exam. I would just use different scenarios that I would get here and there. Maybe I took a class, maybe I'd pull them out of a book. But I would run different scenarios every single day. So the day I went to take the exam, I was well versed on the process of what it was going to be like. It was just a question of did I have enough knowledge? I remember when I left after the deputy's exam, I remember when I left and my father asked me to call him when I was done. So I picked up the phone, I called him. He says, "How'd you do?" I said, "Dad, I did as good as I possibly could have." He goes, "Yeah, you think?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "Now that doesn't mean I think I aced it. I have no idea if I aced it. What I do know is I have no regrets. Every single thing I could think to say, every single thing in every of those four scenarios, I said. So if I don't get it, it's only because I don't have enough information. I'm not, I didn't prepare the right way. But I feel like I could. I and as when the score came out, I ended up getting a perfect score. And so, it was an awesome journey in that aspect where I'm like, it wasn't like I waited for the test. And for the, on this, you should know this. I never ever thought I'm ready for the position. I never thought. I only knew that I'm probably more ready than I'm giving myself credit for. And once I take the test, it's going to be a year or two before I get the opportunity to get promoted. And by that time, I think I would be ready if I'm not now. Matter of fact, a good friend of mine who is the chief of his department, which is one that is a neighboring department to Kearney, he's now the chief of the department. I'll never forget the day he came to visit me and my brother. I think my brother was on duty and I just went up to visit them. But we go into the firehouse and we're sitting down talking. And my brother says to him, because he's a firefighter in the other town, he says, "Are you taking, you're going to take the promotional exam for captain?" He goes, "No." My brother says, "Why not?" He says, I don't think I'm ready." He goes, "Well, you may not be ready now, but the test isn't for 6 months from now. And then the promotion won't happen another 6 months to 2 years from then. Do you think you'll be ready in 2 to 3 years?" And he says, "I don't know, maybe." He goes, "Well, then you have to take the test now." Now he's the chief of that department. And of course, this is many years later, but we've many times revisited that conversation where he'd say, "Thank God for your brother, because your brother just explained to me." And I write about this in my books. You'll never know if you're ready. You have to take action. The best way to determine whether or not you're capable of doing something is to act on it. And I think we all many times will surprise ourselves and find out we were much more capable of doing things that we had thought we were capable of doing. And then once you're there, and long before you get there, I should say, but once you're there, like I said with my first day at work, wow, this is real. It's not a game. You have an obligation to the community you serve and the department you're leading to be the absolute best leader you can. Where I think some people get it right is that they start expressing and showing those leadership qualities long before they get the promotion. Those are the people that get it right. And I always admire that because I think leadership's apparent long before you get bars on your collar.
I kind of just, this is like a personal question I'd like to ask. What did your father retire rank wise and your brother?
My father, it's interesting. He was actually on the list to be promoted to captain, but he retired. And so he could have actually gotten promoted and stayed a couple more years, but he had already done 30 years on the job. My brother and I both retired as deputy chiefs. And I like to say, my shift relieved his shift. So he would be going off duty, we'd be coming on, so we'd be able to exchange information. And I also like to joke that anytime there was a fire on his shift, we would come in, relieve their crew, then go back to the incident and a complete extinguishment for them. But that's not the case. The fact is, they were very good at what they did. Very good.
No, I like, no, I like that conversation of the promotion, the promotional steps and knowing you're ready well beforehand. With that being said, did you always have aspirations of chief, or was it just you were just going to see wherever the road takes you, it takes you?
I think I early on, I probably didn't early on, like the first 5, 6, 7 years, because it just seemed so far out of reach, you know? And then what happened is, I remember the first time it hit me, because I was the firefighter that would be cleaning the deputy chief's office. And the deputy chief would be out with the chief or at a meeting at the town hall or somewhere. And here I am cleaning the office. And I'm just kind of looking around. And I'll never forget, I put the mop down, leaned it against the bed. I sat in the deputy's chair in front of the computer. And I just sat there for a moment. And the exact words that came to my mind were, "Why not me? Why can't I be here?" And it was the first time that that little seed was planted. And of course, then I got up because I didn't want to be sitting in the seat if the deputy walked in, finished cleaning the bathroom, mopping the floors, doing everything. And that little dream was built. And then there was another time where the deputy asked me, he said, "Hey, we need to go to another station and pick something up." I said, "Okay, is the engine going?" He goes, "No." He goes, "I want you to take my vehicle, go down to the station, pick it up, and come back." An unorthodox thing to do back in the day, you know, but I remember driving from one station to the other station in his vehicle, thinking, "Why not me? Why not me?" So, like, the two of those things together kind of planted that seed of, you know, because I believe this wholeheartedly. Things happen twice in life. First time it happens is right here in your mind. The second time is when it happens for real. Every book I'd ever written was a book long before it became a book, right? Everything you've ever achieved, you have to, you know, conceive it before you could actually achieve it. And so those were just a couple things that helped kind of light that fire. And it was my job to go burn the forest down once the fire was lit. Probably a terrible analogy for a firefighter, but you know what I mean.
Yes. Okay. Upon getting that dream that you planted, you know, the seed that you planted in your head, being deputy chief, was it everything you thought it would be?
Yeah, you know what? I remember thinking this at one of my first structure fires. I'm like, okay, you know, the stakes are a lot higher right now, because decisions that I made prior to this were decisions that affected my crew. Decisions I make right now affect the entire team, affect the overall operation, affect whether or not these people are getting out alive or not. Like, I could legitimately make or break an incident. And so the level of preparation and what I was studying for shifted. From, okay, I need to know basic tactics to know. I need to understand how fires work. I need to understand the enemy, building construction. You know, I need to understand how, without proper coordination, a firefighter or civilians could get severely injured or killed. And it was all about that type of stuff and training. And again, you know, I'm in a good situation. I have some really good officers that worked for me. I think that was a blessing. You know, we did a lot of cross training where we would bring multiple companies out at the same time and train on more than one thing at once. You know, where in the past, maybe it was, hey, the engine's going down to draft, and so they're off by themselves. Ladder company's going to go raise and position the aerial ladder. They're off by themselves. We started doing things where we've got a building now to train on. We're going to put two lines in operation. We're going to do search and rescue, put some mannequins in on there, have an outside vent person go out and vent, work on a coordination communication and the key areas of fire, right? You know, water supply, hose line selection and deployment, ladder in the building, forcible entry, search and rescue, ventilation, and coordination. You work on those seven things every single day. You know, those are the basics. And you work on those back to basics every single day. I often tell people that's why I like being, you know, a youth baseball coach and being a officer in a fire service. It's very similar in a few different ways. One is, if you want to be great at it, you master the basics. If you master the basics, you win championships. It's that simple. And both of them also have another thing in common. They're both a lot more fun when you're good at it. So the more you train, there's a lot of benefits that are associated with it.
I did kind of forget to ask this question. With you being deputy chief, were you like deputy chief of operations? What were the parameters that you were pretty much under?
Well, the way that we're structured as a deputy chief, I operated in many departments in a similar fashion as a battalion chief would. We responded to calls. And when you responded to calls, as a battalion chief, if it's in your battalion, you might be the incident commander. As a deputy chief, you are the incident commander anywhere in town, wherever you respond to. That being said, we would also working out of our office, the deputy chief's office. We were assigned specific administrative duties. One was in charge of apparatus and staffing. One was in charge of technology, computers. I was in charge of grant writing and policies. So, I ended up doing a lot of that type of work, which was very difficult actually, because you have to take the hat off, this hat off, and put that one on. You'd respond to a call, you come back, and now you have, 3 days to get a grant completed. And I read somewhere once that it takes about 27 minutes when you are distracted to get your mind back where it was prior to the distraction. So you can imagine if you're writing a paragraph for a grant on why you can't fund this through local resources, why you're asking for that grant money, and all of a sudden a call comes in. And it could be nothing. It could be a smoke alarm activation because the battery needs to be replaced. But you left the building, responded to the call, came back. And now what happens? Now you're thinking, okay, I got a couple apparatus that are not in right now. If something happens, I may need to move some people around. I got some reports that are kind of come in that I need to review before I, submit them. But I have to go back to this grant. And you open it up, and all of a sudden you realize you had two emails come in while you were gone, and you missed the phone call. It's tough to get back on track. And that was the hard part about balancing too. And so this is why I'm very, very aware of when people wear multiple hats. Of how difficult that sometimes can be. And so I try to be very patient with them and say, okay, if two different jobs are basically calling you for you to complete, we have to sit down and figure out which one's a priority. Brian Tracy has a small book on this called Eat That Frog. Nobody wants to eat a frog. But if this is the priority, if this is what you need to do, well, then eat that frog. And if you eat that frog, the other stuff is going to seem simple. You got the hard thing out of the job. And I remember him in the book saying, if there's two frogs to eat, eat the ugly one first. Get that off your plate and get it off your plate. And so because it's easy. Okay, well, I have to write a grant, but I have to do reports. And right now, I can't get my mind on writing the grant. So I'm going to focus on the reports. But the grant's the one that's due. That's the one that's due. And these other things, maybe you could push not aside, but maybe you could delegate it to somebody else and say, do me a favor, review this report for me. You got six officers you work with on a daily basis. Somebody else can probably help with that. But you're the only one doing this other task of writing the grant. So those kinds of challenges would occur, which is fine. It's not like any other job. I mean, every other job has those types of things too, where you wear multiple hats.
This next question, I definitely would love, cannot wait to hear your thoughts and answer on it. You're well known for your leadership books, and on social media, your leadership quotes very much directly talk about certain leaders or non-leaders in organizations. Was leadership a key component for you because you saw maybe there was a lack thereof with you going or growing within your department? Or was that just something you figured if you're going to be a chief officer or specifically like the fire chief, you need to have leadership, in the bag, essentially?
I don't think I'm any different than anybody else in saying that. I was sur in the fire service. I was surrounded by some very good leaders, and then I was surrounded by some that I felt weren't doing it the right way. And certainly they could say the same thing about me. So I don't think, again, this isn't an insult on anybody, and it's not a dig on anybody. It's just that leadership's a very personal thing. There's 50 different leadership styles out there, and some people may. They want maybe want to run the fire service like it is the military, or some people want to believe in servant leadership on a whole different aspect, and some people have purpose-driven leadership, and some people have autocratic leadership. Everybody has their own style, And I remember, well, here's the other thing. Everybody responds to a different style too. So my type of leadership style may work with 8 out of 10 people, and 2 people may hate it. They just may hate the way I lead. I'm a very direct person. If you're doing something right, I'm going to tell you. Believe me, I'm going to tell you in a way that is going to make you feel valued. But if you're doing something wrong, I'm going to hold you accountable at the same time. And not without a conversation and not without us trying to fix it. Because if you're unaware or if you're unable to do something, I'm going to work with you. It's when you're unwilling to do something that I don't really have much tolerance for that. And sometimes early on, my leadership style would I would take it personal. How can you do this to me? Right? I'm giving you the time and the training, the tools, the equipments, the guidance, the support, and the environment to succeed in. How come you're putting me in this situation? It would be personal. And I had to take that aside and say, well, it's not personal. Maybe I have to further explain to them what's right and what's wrong. And if they're unwilling to do their job, well, that is insubordination. And I'm going to have to explain the consequences of that. So, I've known people in the industry because you have to understand, I've been traveling now for 15 years doing seminars throughout the world, not just the country, the world. And I have met many, many very strong, positive leaders. I've met several who are the complete opposite. I met people who are they lead like they're dictators. I meet people that will take things personal and hold grudges. And they've explained this to me. I've met people that say, I micromanage. I need to stop micromanaging. And I don't know how. And so we would talk about how to stop micromanaging. It's actually not a very difficult thing to stop. The best thing is that this individual acknowledged that they do it. But I told him, listen, quite simply, you want to manage the outcomes, not the process people do to get to the outcomes. That's step one, right? And you want to understand that everyone has talent, skills, and ability. So you want to put the right person in the right position so you don't feel like you have to look over their shoulder to do things. But the third thing is if you don't feel you have the right people, then you need to delegate to develop them so they have the skills so you are comfortable putting them in these specific positions. Like you can solve these problems. And you know, people that are, let's put it this way. I've never met a person who's not a flawed leader, including myself. I have flaws. I got emotional over something that happened, totally non-work related. It was very personal. I got emotional with a man just a few months ago, meaning I called him up and I had a conversation with him. My emotions got the better of me. And I'm not going to say I said things that I shouldn't have said, but the way I spoke to him, I shouldn't have spoke to him that way. And the next time I saw him, I said, you know what? I owe you an apology. And what I explained to him was this. I said, look, I'm not perfect. I'm an emotional person. I said, I don't regret the way I felt, but I do regret the way I responded. I should have explained it to you better. And so let me take time to explain to you why I got emotional about that. And it had to do with something with my son. Okay. And I explained that when you bring the family into it, it's different. It doesn't feel like something you want to discuss right away. You feel like, you know, hey, I'm going to protect this kid. And it's not nothing that he did. It just the scenario led to that. But the reason that I'm bringing all that up to you is, you know, you were saying, you know, in my department, did I think I could do it better? Yes, but so does everybody else. They all think they can do it better. And that's fine. You know, I coach a baseball team with a handful of other coaches. Every one of them thinks they could do one thing or everything better. So every now and then, I'll say, what do you want to, or actually, I say this a lot to them. What do you want to work on today? Do you want to break up into stations today? If so, what station do you want? Let them take that station. Let them work on what they, I can't do everything. And a lot of them are much better at doing specific things than I am. So my job is to organize the team, run the team, make sure that we're getting everything we need, but it's also to delegate to them, let them run in their lanes and stay out of their way. So their style of leadership when it comes to these boys will be different than my style of leadership, but together, you know, we have to be in sync. And that's how it works. If your style is different than mine, but we're working in the same organization, as long as we have the same goal of where we want to end up, we can get there. And that's ultimately the key and the drive.
Would you, in your opinion, would you say that leadership and accountability go hand in hand?
I think so. I think leadership and accountability are very important, but I'm also a guy that thinks grit and humility go hand in hand. And a lot of people don't see the two of them as going hand in hand. I do. I think you want to be a strong leader. You want to just be successful. You need to have grit. Grit is that great equalizer we talk about. Grit can take the person that doesn't have as much talent and make them more talented because they're putting in the work, and then they'll bridge that gap. But humility is when you do arrive, you didn't get there alone. And if you're leading a team, you can't succeed alone. It's about the team. So you have to know. And by the way, if you're not humble in the fire service, because I'm sure there's even people that'll listen to this and go, well, they may think that they have it all together, and don't need to continue learning, and they're foolish, because this job will humble you. It will humble you. You're not as good as you think you are. That being said, I was a guy that wasn't as bad as I thought I was, because years ago I'm like, I don't know if I'm ready,
No, it you hit it on the because anytime somebody asks, hey, why haven't you taken this promotional tests, and you just think to yourself, well, I don't know if I'm ready yet. I mean, because it's one of those things you're and with that's with anything in life, you like you're never ready to become a parent. You know what I mean? Like, cause there's some people, because I know my mindset with my wife was, well, we need to save up money, and somebody would ask you, well, how much money is enough? And I'm like, I don't know. And they're like, exactly. You just have to do it.
Well, I'll tell you, if I thought I had to save up enough money to have kids, I still would not have kids now. Because when you start, I'm at that point where it's like, all right, we got to start thinking about college. And it's like, oh no, this is it. This is it. You just got to sometimes listen, you have to live your life. I heard a guy, I don't even want to say his name, but he's one of those big gurus on, one of those billionaires out there, trying to get you to sign up for his classes. I like a lot of what he talks about with certain things with investing, but he said something the other day that aggravated me. He's like, if you make $400,000 a year, you're broke. I'm sitting there going, all right, well, let's be realistic about this. If you're making $400,000 a year, you're doing pretty damn good. Okay, you're doing pretty damn good. And I do understand it all depends on your lifestyle choices also. And I do know the economy is not helping with inflation going up. But at the same time, 400,000, you're doing pretty good. So when I hear him say that, I'm like, man, that's just the wrong message. You're going to make everybody feel like they're not adequate enough just so you can get them to sign up for your classes. And I don't like that. At the same time, there's other people out there saying you don't want to save anything at all. You want to pay off everything you have. I believe that too. I don't like debt, but at the same time, there is a balance to that. Things can go wrong and you need money when they do go wrong. What I'm saying is, again, here we are. These are, by the way, if I've mentioned their names, most of your listeners would probably know both names. They're very big, successful leaders in the finance industry. And their stuff pops up on my stuff everywhere because I watch it all the time, even the ones I disagree with. I watch it because I'm always trying to learn too. But two different leadership styles, from what I hear, I've even heard them talk about each other and they don't agree with each other at all. But they're probably in a very similar situation financially. Both have a tremendous amount of assets, both are extremely wealthy, and both of them disagree. And hey, that goes back to what we're talking about earlier, right? So here you are in a team. You may have a leadership style. I have a leadership style. They're completely different, but we can both be successful leading a team with different leadership styles. And sometimes that's what it takes. Sometimes it takes someone that has to be the bad cop in a sense, right? If you ever watched the movie Miracle, you had the coach that everybody loved, and then you had Herb Brooks that people did not love. But Herb Brooks felt like he needed to be that guy to make two teams that hated each other because of the way they competed against each other. I mean, some of these kids knocked each other's teeth out in college, playing hockey. They hated each other, and he had to get them to work together and want to win together. And part of his way of doing that was to make them hate him. Not that I think, that was the deliberate goal going in. I'm going to make them hate me. But he basically said, okay, if you're not going to work together, I'm going to make this. We're going to have the type of workouts right now that you guys are going to really hate. And he's the one in charge of giving them the workouts. But what he's trying to do is bring them together as a team. Yeah, and that's why I love reading leadership books. I love reading biographies. I love attending classes. And what it is if you want to be a better leader, you take what you want and what you feel works with your personality from multiple different people. Somebody may say, I love the way Frank Viscuso does this, but I don't know about this part of what he does. I really prefer the way Anthony Castros does it, who's one of my best friends, by the way, out in California. I love the way he does it. And so I'm going to take this part of Castros, I'm going to take this part of Viscuso, and I'm going to help shape myself to be a more effective leader by implementing some of their tactics. That's what it's about. I tell people a lot when they do attend my classes, if you came here to hear a leadership expert talk, you came to the wrong room. If you came here to hear a leadership specialist talk, you're in the right room. Because I specialize in leading teams, and I do that because I am a constant student of it. But I'm not going to stand here and tell you I'm an expert at doing it because I fail a lot too. And I figure out what doesn't work and then adapt and say, okay, now that I know that doesn't work, here's the best part. Here's the best part. When you do things that you find out doesn't work, if you're smart enough to kind of check that box and say, now I know this doesn't work, here's what happens. When stuff down the line, a year, 2 years down the line, when things start happening, you could be saying, I know where this is going and I don't like where it's going. So I need to adjust and adapt now so we don't end up in the same situation we were in 2 years ago. And you start recognizing it beforehand. That's the ultimate goal. At least what my books and my teaching is, I want to give people a foundation where they could say, okay, now I know how this plays into my scenario and what I need to do. And hopefully that helps. I don't want to feel like I'm rambling here.
No,
Sometimes I feel like I am.
it's I love it. I love hearing your take on it. With that being said, you do travel across the country. You go to several meetings, you go to various fire departments. In your opinion, what do you see the fire service can improve on, or are they doing good when it comes to recruitment or retention?
Well, here's an issue when it comes to recruitment and retention. I think first thing I want to say is this: if you treat your people that are currently there right, they will do your recruiting for you. In other words, people who love where they are would have no problem saying you want to come work with us. And so if you focus on retention, that helps with recruiting. But a couple of things about recruiting and retention is, you have to think about what are the primary reasons why people work. And you can actually put them into six categories. You have time, money, security, recognition, belong to a team, and to make a difference. So let's say we're recruiting for a volunteer fire department. Okay. You don't get time, money, or security. You get those things as a career firefighter. Like you can get time by swapping time with somebody else or working a little overtime and taking that weekend getaway with your family. Changing time here for time there. So you don't get those three. So you could take them off the table. What does a volunteer get? Well, belong to a, listen, think about it. Time, money, security. You don't get it. Recognition, belong to a team, make a difference. Those are the three key things that would drive someone to want to be a part of an organization. So whether or not you are a career or a volunteer firefighter, those are the three things you want to focus on providing for your people. Recognition when they do something well, make them feel like they belong to a team, which they do. And make them feel like they make a difference to the community you serve as well to your organization. Because if you provide those three things for them, they're all in. And when they're all in, there's your retention right there. And there's your recruiting to it in a sense, because they're going to talk to their friends saying, man, I found something great here. You want to be a part of this. So, that's part of it. And I often say this too, don't take it personal if you can't get them all in. Don't take it personal, because again, you can give them the time and the money and or the time, the training, the tools, the equipment, the guidance, the support, and the environment to succeed in. But you can't give them the heart or the desire. They have to bring that to the table. But we could have those conversations. A lot of it starts with just telling people, hey, I'm proud of you. You're doing a great job. And I'm glad you're part of this team. And when you start doing those things, they want to be around that team more often. People want to feel valued, don't they? I do. I
Absolutely.
want to feel valued. I want to be in a room where I feel valued. And if you don't feel valued, so somebody once said to me, like I had a conversation recently about somebody just about this topic. Is there ever a time where it's appropriate to leave the room and go somewhere else? And we had a long talk about, you have to learn how to overcome adversity and deal with adversity and things like that. I agree with that 100%. But there is a time where the damage could become greater than the lesson. And at that point, you have to say, okay, this is not the room for me. These are not my people. I wanted them to be, but it's not. And so now you need to shift. And we're just talking about life in general. I'm actually not even talking about the fire service. I'm just talking about the rooms and the people we hang out with, the people we spend time with. They have to lift us up, And if they don't do that, well, you know what? It doesn't make them bad people. It just may not be your people. What I try to do in the fire service is make everybody feel valued. And it's tough too, because sometimes people will push a button.
Right,
They'll push that
exactly.
button, and I'll be like, why would you possibly put me in that scenario? Or put yourself in that scenario is a better way to put it. Based on what we already have here, which is so good, why would you not want it to be? Yeah. But then sometimes you just have to pull them in and have a conversation and say, what made you think that that was the right thing to say at that time or do? And just have the conversation, because that could go back to those three U's we talked about. Maybe they're unaware they're not supposed to be doing something. Or maybe they're unable to change an old habit. Those two things we could work with. If they're unwilling, that's a problem.
Love it, love it. Would you say that's the same thing when, and unfortunately, I'm sure we have it in all aspects of life, no matter what profession you're in. But when it comes to the fire service, specifically, like company officers, individuals that look at it as I just want the bugles, the prestige, the pay. But they don't want the response. Like they want all the good things that come with it. But when it comes to having to discipline somebody, having difficult conversations, and even leading by example, would you say that there's a shortcoming there?
So that's a lot of things roll in my mind when you ask that question. Because I've met people that seemed to be disengaged and could easily have fallen into that description. But when you dive deeper into it, sometimes I find out that they just were people that were frustrated. And like I like to put people in four categories. You got your hard chargers. Those are the ones we want. They get things done. You got your coasters. You have your complainers, and you have your corner mutts who sit in the corner and bark. Okay. And here's the thing: hard chargers, that's of course, that's what you want. These are the in college athletes, these are the All-Americans. Your coasters do the minimum. But if you set a good enough, strong enough, high standard, the minimum is really the best practices. If you're implementing the best practices and saying this is our standard, well, then that minimum is a pretty high standard. So if you coasters are people that just do what they're supposed to do and that's it. And that doesn't have to be a bad thing. Again, if we have the right culture. Complainers are a problem, and complainers and corner mutts look and sound exactly alike. You wouldn't know the difference unless you knew them personally or got sat down to talk with them. Complainers could be people that are frustrated. They've been micromanaged. They feel underappreciated. They feel devalued. They feel like they've tried and everything they've tried has fallen upon deaf ears. Corner mutts don't give a shit. Those are the people that if you're talking about, hey, I'm here for the pension, I'm here for the benefits, I'm here for the rank and the title and the prestige, move on. Move on, because that's dangerous. But what I find is people that I've, in my experience, the corner mutts tend to not even get to that level of promotion many times, you know, because they never cared to do it anyway. They don't care to, all they find is fault with the organization. If all you ever find is fault with an organization, at some point you have to sit back and say, okay, am I part of the problem? Because everything can't be broken. Something has to be right, you know, unless you have a group of 25 people out of 25 that all find fault in everything. You know, sometimes you are a complainer, you're in a rut. And what you need to do is step out of that rut, you know, dust yourself off and say, okay, that's not who I want to be. I am frustrated. You have a right to be frustrated. What I like to tell people is this: whatever you're feeling, you have absolute right to feel the way you feel. But you don't have a right to take a negative feeling and spread that to other people and want them to be negative too. What we need to do now is figure out what we need to do to fix whatever problem is you're dealing with. You know, let's work in a solution, not with the problem. The world's full of problem finders. We need more problem solvers. That's why firefighters exist, right? That's why people in the emergency services exist, to solve problems. So, you know, you want to talk about leadership, leadership 101. Hey, man, identify a problem, assemble a group of people, develop a solution, solve the problem. Four simple steps. You do those things over and over, you're a problem solver. Problem solvers are leaders. And that's it. We complicate it a lot, but that's it. And here's the other simplistic thought. You can always become, if you don't know what type of leader you are yet, become the leader you always wanted to work for. And that means, what is that? Like, if we were to sit and define what is a great leader, well, they're knowledgeable and they're competent. All right. They make good decisions. They treat people right. You know, you could just sit down the list and say, what works for me? Who would I want to work for? You don't just want to work for the good guy that wants to be your friend. Of course, I want to work for the good guy. I do. But I want to work for the good guy that's going to sit down and tell me when I'm doing something stupid and not care about hurting my feelings so I can know that I'm doing something stupid. You know, so you want to be with those people. In a sense, you know, I try to tell people in leadership positions that in many ways you want to treat people like they're your children. Now, on the surface, that statement comes across wrong. Oh, why would you tell them to treat people like children? I never said to treat them like children. Treat them like they're your children. The same way you would want your children to be treated if they're doing something right or if they're doing something wrong, so we can help them make better decisions.
Absolutely. And one thing I want to ask you, because you mentioned it, because I know individuals like that, good individuals that have been beaten down so much that they're frustrated. And could those individuals be brought back into the hard chargers category?
Without question. Without question. You know why pigs don't mind rolling around in the mud, smelling and stinking like a pig? Because pigs don't know pigs stink. That's the environment they're rolling around in. So it's the only environment they know. When someone's sitting at the kitchen table at work complaining about how much the job sucks, it's like a pig rolling around in the mud and they don't realize that they're doing it. They do it to a point where it just becomes habit. Habits are a very real thing. So what you need to do is kind of step away. First thing is identifying, okay, and I've done this before. I've identified for sure that I was a complainer during a portion of my career to a point where sometimes I would find myself complaining because I wanted to justify my feelings. I wanted other people to say, hey, you're right. I agree with you. I wanted that, right? And you get to a point where I did anyway, where I hated hearing myself talk. Because I'm like, Frank, man, if you were on the other side of this table, you'd be like, this guy, all he does is complain. And so that was a big realization for me. And so I said, okay, I need to change. I need to change. And then what happens is when you do change and you're sitting in a room where other people are doing it, it's almost like a drug, man. You're like, hey, I want to get back in there and I want a shot at that too. You're right. This place does suck. Our chief is this. That new guy is this. You're right. And you want, yeah. And all of a sudden, you're back in it, rolling around in the mud. So, first thing we need to do is identify it. And it's almost like you got to kick yourself under the table, like, don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it. And I don't think there's anything more empowering for a person, for me anyway. Probably nothing more empowering than restraint. When I know what I want to say, but I do know it's not the right thing to say. So to be able to just hold back and say, for the betterment of this entire organization and everybody in this room, I'm not going to say the one thing that I want to say. Because I know once I say it, I can't go back. There's a better way for me to handle it. Because what you want to say is not always what should be said. And that's when I teach the class, I talk about you need strategy and tactics to put out fires, right? Well, you need strategy and tactics to put out people fires too. And you're going to fight a lot more people fires than you ever will structure fires in your career if you're going to be an officer in this industry.
No, that's a fact. And that's where sometimes I feel not, and I want to say clearly say not all organizations, but there are a good majority of organizations where to become company officer, it's a checkbox list of, okay, he knows tactics, he knows SOG, SOPs, but when it comes to the human element of knowing your people, getting to know the different type of people that will serve under you or you serve with them, that's where I feel like the fire service is lacking, you know. And the best analogy is whenever we put an apparatus committee together, I mean, people are dialed in to we want this here, this there. They think of measurements, all that. But when it comes to company officers or developing company officers into where it's like, hey, you're going to have an employee who's going to come into your office and be like, hey, Cap, just let you know, I came home yesterday and my family's gone. Like, what do you say to that?
Right. Oh man. Yeah, you're hitting it. You're hitting it on the nail on the head. This is what I do. Exactly what I do, man. I when I travel around, we're talking about how to develop those cultures where you can have those kind of bonds. Like for example, one of the things that I tell people to do, if you're, let's just say you're a battalion chief, you want to have a 1 minute conversation with everybody you work with every day. And in your battalion, let's just say there's 22 people. And these are big numbers if you compared to most departments in the country. Most people are coming in, hey, I only work with the same two people every day. You work with the same two people, it's easy to do more than what I'm about to share with you and have an hour-long conversation. But for me, it's a one-minute conversation of good morning, how are you? I'm doing good, Chief. How are you doing? I'm doing great. How'd your daughter do in her soccer game last weekend? And that's what I want to talk to them about. What's important to them? Because I want them to know that their family is important to me. What's happening in their life? Hey, did you close on the house? How was your vacation? 1 minute conversation to let them know that I value them. And of course, now we're going to have work-related, tremendous amount of work-related conversations that happen every day. Okay. But I want that 1 minute to know it's about them. And if they want to talk for 10 minutes about their family and I have 10 minutes, we'll sit down and we'll talk 10 minutes about the family and just have that kind of connection start to occur. So when they are going through challenges, and I've had this multiple times, on duty and off, my phone rings and it's a firefighter that's asking for some guidance in one area or another that has nothing to do with the job. It has to do with stuff that's happening off duty. And when that stuff happens, it makes me feel like, hey, we're, you know, this is good because we're looking at each other like we're a family, not just coworkers. And we're lucky in the fire service. We have two families, but families are often dysfunctional in this world too. So you can have a dysfunctional family at home and a dysfunctional family at the fire service. You could have both of them, or you could take the leadership role in both areas, implement some of the things that, you know, we talk about regularly and say, I'm going to implement this in my home life and in my personal life, my professional life. And watch what happens when you start doing those things. And it won't always be perfect. Even on the team that I'm coaching, we had two kids that had a conflict amongst each other. They're 13 years old. Conflict. And this was in the middle of a tournament. between day one and day two. So at day two, while everybody was in the cages hitting, working out, getting ready for the game, I pulled those two aside and talked to them. And I explained to them, I said, "You guys, I know you're not seeing eye to eye on everything right now. And a part of both of you does not like a part of the other person. I get that. And what I want you to know is that's real life. That stuff happens in real life. But here's what I need you to understand. Both of you are very effective leaders. Both of you are leading different groups on this team. They follow you. They look up to you. Can you imagine what can happen to this team if you both were in sync and working together? Doesn't mean you have to love everything about each other. It just means you have to love where we want to go as a team and work together and stop looking at each other's flaws and start looking at each other's strengths." I said, "The truth is, I respect both of you." And I looked one of them in the eyes. And I shook his hand. I said, "Look me in the eyes. I respect you." I shook hands with the other one. I said, "I respect you." I said, "Here's my question. Can you two say that to each other?" And one turned to the other, shook his hand. He says, "I respect you." And the other one says, "I respect you." And it was hard. And it didn't feel extremely genuine at that moment, but it's a step in the right direction. Because now, okay, now we know we can get that far. Now let's move on and try to now get you both in sync with where we want to go as a team. Because they both have tremendous qualities. They're both great athletes. They both are leaders. And neither one of them are wrong in how they feel. They're justified. If you have an issue with somebody, you have a reason to have the issue. It doesn't mean it's right. Because a lot of times there's just misinformation out there. But the way you feel is the way you feel. And I want them to know that. I'm not upset that you guys don't love each other right now. I'm not upset that you're not getting along. I'd be upset if we don't do something about it. So let's focus on what we need to do to fix it.
That's awesome. That's awesome. One last question, because I'm sure you're a very busy guy. Was it, I don't want to say was it always the plan, but with the way your mind works and how you can make firefighters see the correlation between the fire service and leadership, was that something when once you retired, you're like, hey, like, everybody has like a niche or a really good purpose or skill set. Was that something that you were like, I'm going to pursue this more, because with what you do traveling to, fire departments, it is very much needed.
No, I appreciate. Well, listen. So, okay. Did I plan to do this? No, I didn't plan to do this. When I wrote Tom and Valor, I wrote it with two fingers using my thumb for the space bar. I was reading a book on how to write a book when I wrote it. And it was probably about 8 years later that I wrote Step Up and Lead. And when I wrote Step Up and Lead, I didn't think anybody would ever read it. Nobody read Common Valor back then. So why would anybody read my second book? The book started taking off. People started asking me to come in and speak. In business, outside the fire department, and as an instructor in the fire department, I did a bit of speaking anyway. So that part wasn't unusual. But I didn't know there was organizations out there that brought people in to speak about the stuff that I speak. I had no idea. So when people started asking me to come in 15 years ago, and it's never stopped. But when people started asking me to come in, I mean, the first guy was out in Connecticut, and I went out there for 4 days and I worked with them. Then the second one was out in Texas. Where did it come from? I have no idea. Somebody just read the book and said, "Hey, we need this training." Great. So I bought a plane ticket, went out to Texas, probably lost more money than I made on that deal, So it wasn't a career or anything at that time. I didn't think it was going to turn into a career, but I have had more times than you can imagine. And I mean, I've done over 1,000 presentations. And I could say it's happened at multiple times at every one. So to be conservative, I've heard at least 1,000 times what you're doing is needed in the fire service. Keep doing it. I hear it every single time. I just got back from where was I? In Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, at a fire conference, and had about 310 people, 315 in the room. And afterwards, as I'm walking out, I had two people stop me as I'm walking out. thanking me for sharing something, and I could tell that one of them was job related, the other one was not. One of them was related to his relationship with his son. So one related to the job, one was related to his relationship with his son. And then I went out to have lunch, and a man walked up to me and he says, and I'm now I changed out of the suit and everything. And the guy says, "Hey, you're the guy that just gave that talk, aren't you?" I said, "Yeah." And his eyes well up, and he starts telling me a personal story that was similar to one that I shared on the stage. And he says, "Hearing you talk about that was something I needed because of something that happened more than 20 years ago." And so, because of that, I often feel like, you know what, I'm supposed to do this. I'm supposed to do it. And I don't actively go out and try to seek people to ask me to come in and speak. They just come in regularly all the time. And I'm not very aggressive with like following up on it because I have more than I could do. But I am very thankful for every email that comes in. I respond to everyone within 2 hours of receiving it, unless I'm actually speaking or at my son's game. But I respond immediately, and like right now, I'm going to Peoria, Illinois, for another fire conference. I'm keynoting out next week. After that, 2 days in Penticton, Canada, followed by a day in Woodland, California the next week, then Florence, Alabama, then Medicine Hat, Alberta, Canada. And the next week it's 3 days in Lansing, Michigan, followed by 3 days in California again, a day in Marlboro, 3 days in Naples, Florida, 4 days in St. Charles County, Missouri, 1 day in Plainfield, Indiana, then 2 weeks off for Christmas.
Man.
And I tell you, and you may say, "Well, that's an awful lot of traveling." It is an awful lot of traveling, but you need to know something. I actually map it out. The amount of days that I worked when I was working full time as a fire chief is almost the exact amount of days I still work today. No days more. In other words, I don't want to spend 1 day more away from my family than I have to. So there are several months here, namely July and August, that I might work 1 day, maybe 1 day. Because those are important months for my family. And before I even put anything on my calendar, I go through the year and say, these are the important dates, the important weeks that I'm not scheduling anything on. And the rest of it is solely focused on helping people get from where they are to where they want to be. And like I said, man, step up and lead and Flashpoint, the two classes that I primarily teach, the officer development workshops, all that stuff. It started out as how to lead better in a fire service. But when I started sharing some personal stories about coaching or about my son or my wife or challenges I've gone through on a personal level, when I've shared those, I didn't expect the response to come back from people the way that it has. Like when I tell people that I'm an overthinker, when I ask, is anybody in this room an overthinker? At least 30% of the hands in every room goes up. When I ask, has anybody here ever worked for a micromanager? At least 90% of the hands in every room I ask that question and go up. So when I talk about these things, I'm like, okay, well, I can give you some information that can help you. Because if 90% of Americans feel like they've worked for a micromanager, that means there's an awful lot of micromanagers out there. And either we're all being micromanaged or none of us like being told what to do ever. And we perceive everything as micromanagement. So let's first talk about what it is. And here's the bottom line. If I ask you to tie a knot and you tie a knot, the worst thing I could do is say, yeah, it's the right knot, but I don't like the way you tied it. Tie it my way. Here's how I tie it, because now I'm micromanaging your process. So these are the things we talk about in the class about how to do it right, how to basically what to keep doing, stop doing, and start doing. That's what we basically talk about. What works that you should keep doing, what's not working that you need to stop doing, and what are you not doing at all that you need to start doing so we could get better results. And what you find out is leadership in any industry is transferable. If you could lead strong in the fire service, many of those things that you're doing to lead a team in a fire service can help you lead your family. And so, and will help you succeed in other areas. So hopefully that is helpful to the listeners, based on a question you asked.
No, definitely, definitely. And if any department or any individual, specifically related to the fire service wants to get a hold of you, how would they go about doing so?
I'm very easy to get a hold of. I mean, you can find me on social media, under Frank Viscuso. On Step Up and Lead, I have a Step Up and Lead Facebook page, Meta. That's pretty active. That's the one I think you referred to earlier. Then you got my website that you can go to, frankviscuso.com or commonvalor.com, and I have Flashpoint, which is a training website. I'm sorry, FireOps Online, which is my training website. But if you just type in my name, my email is on my website. My cell phone number is on my website. People say, "I can't believe you leave your cell phone out there." I'm like, man, I'm telling you what, I love the calls that I get. If I can't take the call, I just tell the person I can't talk right now. But I get some calls from people throughout the country, and a lot of them are pretty awesome. People just say, "Man, I attended your class. I read your book. I just got promoted, and I just want to say thank you." And nothing could be more inspiring for me to hear than that. And other times it's like, hey, I'm going through some really difficult challenges in my life. And I know you talk about some of the situations that you've dealt with other people in your life. And I was wondering if I could just have a minute of your time. And we have those conversations. And I'm open for all of that. Listen, what is it about, Danny? At the end of the day, what's life about, man? I'll tell you what, I don't know what we're all going to think at the end, but I got to think it's about relationships. I really do. I have to think it's about relationships. And if we can get good at developing better relationships, we can get good at life, and we could have a more fulfilled life.
Absolutely. Definitely. Chief, I really appreciate you accepting the invite, coming on, talking shop, dropping nuggets that hopefully people can relate to, understand, and definitely self-reflect. Like, am I that person that he's talking about? Am I doing that? Are those my habits? So I just want to say thank you very much for coming on and doing this.
Well, likewise, thank you for the invite. I appreciate you reaching out to me and asking. Somebody once said to me, "Hey, how can I get Frank Vizuso on my podcast?" I said, "It's easy. Ask him. If I'm available, I love to talk and love to share some stuff." And you just hope somebody, like you mentioned, somebody gets that one nugget. They said, "Hey, that's what I needed to hear today." That's the one thing I find about the social media. When I put a post out, somebody, even yesterday, I said, "Feeling sad about a bad decision doesn't mean it was the wrong decision." And somebody responded and said, "That's exactly what I needed to hear today. Thank you." We're in this together. We're in it together, so let's try to get through it together. But that being said, thank you, my friend. I appreciate you. I appreciate what you're doing with your show here. Good luck to it, and I appreciate the invite.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
Take care.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.